Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Over the weekend, embattled House Majority Leader Tom DeLay told members of the National Rifle Association that when a man's in trouble, you want to have your friends around, preferably armed. DeLay is under fire for alleged ethics allegations, and former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott was one of the Republicans who took to the airwaves yesterday defending DeLay on ABC's This Week.
This is a manufactured controversy. It's a continuation of the politics of personal destruction we've seen in Washington for years.
Well, joining us on the line for a look at this and other issues in Congress at the beginning of a new week, John Harwood, national political editor of the Wall Street Journal. And John, as supporters inside the NRA convention cheered Tom DeLay, 100 or so people outside the hall demonstrated against him, some from his own district. What do you read into that?
You know, it's a tough time for Tom DeLay. The good news for him is that the Republicans who are really putting heat on him remain sort of outliers. You've had a couple of members of Congress say he ought to step down, and Newt Gingrich has said he needs to go before the American people and explain himself. But most Republicans are holding tight behind him. It's a very polarized country, and oftentimes when one of the prominent red state or blue state politicians gets attacked by what is perceived as the other side, their own side rallies behind him.
Right, and we should remind ourselves that Tom DeLay was admonished three times last year for what was called strong-arm political tactics. And then Tom DeLay, changed the rules of the Ethics Committee, and now Democrats won't allow the committee to meet because of the rule change. How do you see that being resolved?
Well, I think the Tom DeLay situation will provide some impetus, Robin, for getting it resolved, because the more Republicans are seen to be somehow blocking things to Tom DeLay's benefit, while this is a public controversy, that just increases the risk that Republican members will get questions about it in their district and face some political heat themselves. And ultimately, when it starts to affect you, that's when people may look at the situation and say, we've got to do something.
Well, and some might apply that same analysis to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. He has agreed to speak via videotape next weekend to the Conservative Family Research Council about Democrats' opposition to a few of President Bush's judicial nominees, and Frist characterized that opposition as an assault against people of faith. The New York Times says Bill Frist has launched a religious war. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't think that opposition to the judicial nominations of the president represents an assault on people of faith, and I don't think that Bill Frist has launched a religious war. What Bill Frist is doing is running for president, and one of the things that he's trying to do, we saw it in the Schiavo case, we see it in the case of the filibuster, is cement his allegiance and the loyalty of conservative Christians who are very important in the Republican Party. Some of the prospective rivals for that nomination in 2008, like John McCain, Rudy Giuliani, are people who are not darlings of the conservative Christians, and Bill Frist, aside from the substantive reasons that he may be taking these positions, would like to get out ahead among that constituency.
You mentioned the filibuster, and that's at the heart of the telecast next weekend. The filibuster, of course, the tool that any party can use to block a president's nominations for judge, and the flyer that's being handed out by the Family Research Council has a headline that says, "The filibuster was once abused to protect racial bias. It's now being used against people of faith." Could you put that a little more in context for us?
Well, the filibuster became famous to Americans in a couple of different contexts in the past. One was, through an old Jimmy Stewart movie when he was sort of standing up for the average guy. The filibuster got an unfavorable context during the 1960s when Southern segregationists used it to try to block civil rights legislation, and that was one of the things we all remember. Strom Thurmond had a very extended filibuster that was, I think, he set the record 24 hours or so talking on the Senate floor. Nowadays, the use of the filibuster has become fairly routine, and just as all politics is local, Robin, it's also all situational. If you're in the minority, the filibuster is one of the most important weapons you have in the U.S. Senate for stopping what the other side wants to do. They don't want to lose a tool either, and that's one of the reasons why some members of the Republican caucus are ambivalent about going along with what Bill Frist wants to do.
How likely are the Republicans going to be to get a rules changed to get rid of the filibuster?
It looks pretty likely that they're going to try. They do not appear to have the votes in their pockets at this point. There are some Northeastern moderates who are worried about looking too close to conservatives in the Republican Party who are resisting. There's some traditionalists in the Senate who don't want to change the way things have been done there. And we see John Warner, for example, past Armed Services Chairman in the Senate, been in the body a long time. John McCain, something of a maverick, he is also indicating that he's not too keen on changing the rules. So until they pull the trigger on it, we can't be sure that they either will do it or they have the votes to do it.
Your thoughts on another dust-up. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has scheduled to vote tomorrow on the nomination of John Bolton as U.S. ambassador. Over the weekend, Republican Senator Chuck Hagel expressed some doubts about the nomination. What does that mean? It was thought that the John Bolton nomination was a sure thing.
Well, the Bolton nomination to get to the Senate floor needs to be voted out of the Foreign Relations Committee. We have assumed that the swing vote is going to be Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island and that other Republicans were sure to vote for him. If there are more defections, that's a real problem for Bolton. Democrats kept up the assault over the weekend, publicizing more allegations about Bolton being heavy-handed and kind of a bully in relating to his colleagues. But the way it stood at the end of the week, and we'll see what happens when the vote gets cast in the Foreign Relations Committee, is that Bolton probably would get through on a party-line vote. Then Democrats could try to use the filibuster against him. But I'm not sure that Democrats are going to want to use that weapon for a job like this, given the fact that a lot of Americans, in fact, themselves are ambivalent about the U.N.
John Harwood, National Political Editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And staying with politics, the Republican strategist who helped New York Governor George Pataki defeat Mario Cuomo in 1994 is now setting his sights on Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. Arthur Finkelstein is the man behind a political action committee and a website called Stop Her Now, a campaign against Hillary Clinton that Finkelstein hopes will be as successful as the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign against John Kerry. But the story took an interesting turn last week when Senator Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton, was asked about Finkelstein's recent gay marriage to his longtime male partner. Clinton remarked that Finkelstein, a man who has worked vigorously to elect anti-gay rights candidates such as Jesse Helms, may be blinded by self-loathing. Michael Goodwin is a columnist with the New York Daily News. He recently wrote about this episode in a column titled, He's the Mouth That Roars, and Michael joins us. Michael, your thoughts on Bill Clinton's comments?
Well, I think generally we give Bill Clinton a lot of credit when it comes to politics. This one, as I said in the column, is something of a head-scratcher, though, because it makes very little sense. This is one where I think a lot of gay people would be offended by the notion that somehow it's self-loathing. Self-loathing is one of those phrases that really sets off the bells.
Well, you know, you write further that it assumes that all minorities will think and vote the same way, but isn't there a difference between, let's say, being a gay American and not believing in gay marriage, and being a gay American who takes part in a gay marriage but then fights against it for other gay Americans?
Well, to a certain extent, yes, but I think that one doesn't have to belong to a political party for one reason only, and I think that's a problem here. Bill Clinton has basically set up a litmus test for gays, although he himself is not gay. So he has said, if you are gay and you want to have a gay marriage, as Finkelstein did, then you must be a Democrat. Now, the problem there is the Democratic Party, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, do not believe in gay marriage. They both oppose it.
Well, Bill Clinton also said either this guy believes his party is not serious and he's totally Machiavellian, or he goes on to say he's blinded by self-loathing. Isn't the first part of that sentence an important observation? I mean, what does it say about the Republican Party that a lead operative doesn't believe in the same thinking that he uses to rally party members?
Well, I think you're making a leap there. Finkelstein happens to have a home in Massachusetts, I guess, so he was able to take advantage of the Massachusetts situation where the courts ordered gay marriage so that he could get married there. I don't think it's necessarily hypocritical to say he's therefore working against it in other states, or because he is, that he's hypocritical. I think each of those states had a ballot issue. And as I point out in the column, Bill Clinton urged John Kerry to support the ban on gay marriage in those states, thinking he could help win those states in the last presidential election. So any way you slice Clinton's comments, let's focus on him instead of Finkelstein. Finkelstein is a private person participating in the public process through his occupation. Bill Clinton's, I think, the more interesting character here. And his comments, I think, do not stand up to scrutiny.
Well, it's funny because some people might say that Mr. Finkelstein's hypocrisy, as they might see it, is far more important politically than Bill Clinton's comments on it. And many are wondering why more haven't written about Mr. Finkelstein's gay marriage. Did you write about it and what some would see as an apparent hypocrisy?
The only article on it was in the New York Times when Clinton spoke. I mean, Clinton's whole quotation is about there are two stories over the weekend about Finkelstein. One is the marriage and the other is the Stop Hillary, Stop Her Now mm-hmm. website and PAC that he's setting up. So Clinton, I think it was on Monday, both of these stories appear over the weekend. On Monday, Clinton comes out of the gate and starts to links the two things and says, this is the, you know, the Machiavellian or the self-loathing.
Well, now to be fair, he was asked. He was actually launching his AIDS initiative, and he was asked by a reporter.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't think Bill Clinton has any excuse to bring in the guy's private life. And don't forget, Bill Clinton's a guy who said that what he did with Monica Lewinsky in the Oval Office was nobody's business.
But again, some would say the difference in this case is that Mr. Finkelstein is someone who's advised candidates in a party, the Republican Party, that's claimed higher moral values and used gay marriage as a wedge issue.
No, I understand your point. I think the issue is Bill Clinton, not Arthur Finkelstein.
And while we have you, Michael, reporting as you do for the New York Daily News from New York, what is the sense of how this campaign against Hillary Clinton is going to work? Again, Arthur Finkelstein calling for a political action committee, a website, Stop Her Now, wants to raise millions of dollars. What's been the response to that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the campaign will fail if it's aimed at stopping her reelection in New York. She's up for re-election in 2006. I think this is really about whether she's going to run for president in 2008. And I believe she is. I believe she's already started that. And I think that what Arthur Finkelstein and other Republicans are hoping to do is to bring up a lot of issues during her campaign to perhaps narrow her victory margin and to, in effect, dirty her up so that these issues get raised again in the presidential campaign 2 years after that. The problem for those who want to stop Hillary in 2006 in New York is right now they don't have a candidate. And so I don't think anyone's going to be able to stop Hillary in New York in 2006. Mm. I might add, too, if I could, on this very issue, this is a kind of thing, I think, with Bill Clinton, though, that can hurt Hillary. Because it reinforces the notion of her as an appendage of him. And I think if she's going to sail on her own, if she's going to be seen as an independent woman, who she clearly is, very smart and very learned and works very hard at being a good senator, I think Bill Clinton is going to have to sink to the background a little more. He can't be out there causing these dust-ups and looking like he's got to defend her. I mean, this is fake chivalry anyway. I mean, he's the guy who was chasing other women and humiliating Hillary. So I really think he needs to kind of pipe down and let her be an independent politician now and not just his wife.
Michael Goodwin, columnist for the New York Daily News. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Well, just ahead, a police task force in Washington, D.C. works to improve relations with the gay and lesbian community. And later, ultramarathoning, races 100 miles or more. There's more coming up here and now. Washington, D.C. Police Sergeant Brett Parsons says he's come a long way since he took the helm of the force's Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit in 2001. When faced with five horrific slayings in the city's transgendered community, he realized that as a gay man, he had no idea how to address the transgendered community. Since then, Parsons has grown his unit to include four full-time officers, eight auxiliary and reserve officers, and he's learned to walk the careful line between advocating for the gay community and being prepared to take its members away in handcuffs. Brett Parsons joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And can you start by telling us, what do you do?
Well, I think it's the kitchen sink, quite honestly. We can go from visiting a group in the community to responding to a homicide, and then after that, go to a meeting of the mayor's advisory board. Mm. And then after that, go over to the police academy and start training police officers on how to deal with this community. So we really have quite a variety of tasks that we're responsible for.
How about the whole unit? Is the entire, you know, unit gay?
No, and I think that would be wrong to do, because I think there is a place for our allies. But I do have a little bit of everything. And the acronym that we use now, it's extended to almost the entire alphabet. Now we use GLBTQIA, which is gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, questioning, curious, intersex, and our allies. That's a tongue twister.
Right. How do other police units outside of your unit respond and react to you?
It's been amazing, Robin. I never thought when my career began in law enforcement now almost a dozen years ago that I would find myself being the gay poster child for a police department. And here I am. And my biggest fear was that my reputation would go from being Brett Parson, the great cop who happens to be gay, to becoming Brett Parson, the gay cop who used to be a good cop. And what we found is that's not happening. And the reason why it's not happening is because the officers and the reserves and the civilian auxiliaries that I work with, we work really hard to really integrate ourselves into the larger community, including the police department. And so you won't see us shying away from straight crimes. It's not like we wave a pink hanky, and if you react to it, we'll help you, and if you don't, well, we'll just call for the straight police. And I think that really earns us a lot of respect amongst our peers, because cops respect good cops.
I'm wondering, as a cop, what are some of the cases that you've come across that you think, because you are with this liaison unit, you've brought special care to it or been able to solve it or just did it better than a cop outside the unit would have been able to do it?
Well, I don't know that they wouldn't have been able to do it, but I know that, for instance, the case of Douglas Small. Mr. Small was an executive with America Online, and back in 2002, he went missing. And it wasn't until his friends, who most of them were gay because Mr. Small was openly gay, contacted us at the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit that the focus shifted, quite honestly, from a missing person report to a criminal investigation, because they felt comfortable coming to us and divulging some of the deeper, darkest secrets of his personal life. We were able to investigate and work with our homicide unit, and eventually we located his body. And then eventually located the individual who killed him. Had the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit not existed, could that crime have been solved? Probably eventually. But I think we brought it to a closure much more quickly than it could have been. And I also think that his friends really felt good about being able to be involved with the unit that treated them as truly members of his family.
We understand there are more reports of crimes involving the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community.
Absolutely, and that's not a bad thing. You know, it's one of the few times our chief of police could have been perceived as one of the dumbest chiefs in the country when he stood up proudly and proclaimed that he was proud to announce that hate crimes were up over almost 1,000% in the District of Columbia. Well, that's not something we're ashamed of. In fact, we're very proud of that, because where we started was with the number 2 in 1998. And Robin, I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and I love this city, but there is no way that we only had 2 hate crimes in Washington, D.C. in 1998. It's an exponential growth, but it's still nowhere near what we know is probably out there.
So you're feeling that because of the unit, perhaps, that people are feeling safer in reporting the crimes that are already happening?
Well, when you say because of the unit, they aren't just reporting it to the unit. I think we're also having success in training police officers, that police officers who are not in this unit are also picking up on those clues and asking appropriate questions, and they're earning the trust of the citizens.
On the other hand, Brett Parson, do you ever get any arrests, any criminals, gay or lesbian, or who say to you, hey, wait a minute, I thought, you're one of us?
Absolutely. And that's the balancing act that you talked about during the introduction, Robin. It is the biggest challenge that we have, is balancing between advocates and enforcers.
You said you are of the community, and I am imagining that often that means the crime is personal to you. And I'm remembering just recently Mayor Anthony Wilson's liaison to the gay community, Wanda Alston, was murdered. It sent shockwaves through the entire city, even though it was deemed not to be a hate crime. But do I understand that you were early on to that scene?
Well, yeah, Robin. I mean, this is one of the times that, personal and professional life merge, and for a police officer, that's a horrible conflict when that happens. And Wanda was not only a friend of members of the city, but she was a personal friend of mine. In fact, I was en route when I got the call to a meeting that I was supposed to be at with Wanda, and had to divert to go to the crime scene, And when I arrived, I immediately recognized the address, and I had to identify my friend so that we could positively say to members of the community that this was, in fact, who we thought it was. And, you know, that's a job that I have to do. It's a job that I'm capable of doing, but it takes a toll. And, you know, I don't like seeing friends die, and I certainly don't like having to grieve, but part of me was very happy that Wanda had the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit working for her to quickly capture Mr. Parrott, William Parrott Jr., who murdered her.
Brett Parson is head of the Washington, D.C. Police Force Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit. He's speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Brett, thanks so much for talking to us.
Robin, thanks so much for giving us time to put the word out there that we exist, and I hope that anybody out there in other cities will give us a holler if they need help so that we can maybe help them as well.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Britain will hold general elections on May 5th. Tony Blair, who led the Labour Party to landslide victories in 1997 and 2001, hopes to win a third term as Prime Minister. And campaign promises and political fur are flying. In an effort to woo women voters, Blair's Labour Party pledged today that women suspected of having breast cancer will leapfrog that country's backed-up public health system to get screening. And Conservative Party leader Michael Howard lashed out at the Blair administration for turning the public pension system, Britain's Social Security, into a time bomb. Sound familiar? But according to Here Now's Michael Goldfarb, the war in Iraq may still be the key factor in the coming elections.
The intercity trains race north through Welwyn Garden City as the quieter trains from London pull in, disgorging commuters at the local station. On a brisk April evening, Grant Shapps, the Conservative Party's local candidate for Parliament in the May 5th election, is standing outside, campaigning the old-fashioned way, pressing flesh, listening to voters' concerns.
Hello.
I'm pleased to meet you.
You too. Lovely to,
yes.
Lovely to see you.
I was going to come to the community centre the other week, but I live in Cole Green Lane, but I don't walking up there in the dark. You know what it's like. I got mugged last July, so...
Well, that is the overarching problem in that side of town.
Yeah, right? I know, isn't it? Absolutely.
Violent crime is a concern here in Welwyn Garden City. The woman, in her 70s, lives in a labour ward and gets all the sympathy Grant Shapps can muster.
Yeah, hope you do well.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to see him. So pleased we got to meet you.
Welwyn Garden City was founded in 1920, an early example of a planned suburban community. It is set in rolling, pleasant countryside in Hertfordshire, a 25-minute train ride north of London. Hertfordshire is a bellwether of British voting intentions. Staunchly conservative during the heyday of Margaret Thatcher, Welwyn went Labour in 1997 and again in 2001. Grant Shapps was the Conservative candidate then, narrowly losing to incumbent Labour candidate Melanie Johnson. And this time around, Shapps has a good chance to win. His strategy is to keep the campaign focused on local issues, like the decision by the National Health Service to close the local hospital's paediatric emergency unit.
Is that you?
Yeah. That's me, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So that was...
You know that they're going to close the children's A&E at the...
Yes, I heard about it, and I was so disappointed.
Yeah. Did I send you something about this?
No.
No, you may get it in the next few days.
Right, yeah. Okay, that's fine.
And it's just to ask you to sign the petition against the closure of the children's A&E.
Right, okay.
I think it's absolutely... disastrous.
Yeah, I was like, because I've got two children myself.
You do.
So
but there is another issue, an international issue, that is in the back of people's minds in Welwyn Garden City. Iraq. The war itself, the way it was sold, the subsequent failure to find weapons of mass destruction is the elephant in the room. No one in the top levels of British Prime Minister Tony Blair's government wants to acknowledge that at this election because, according to Grant Shapps, Labour voters feel terribly betrayed by Blair.
I've been out on the doorstep this afternoon, so actually knocking on voters' doors where we actually know specifically who they are from the electoral register and then work through and talk to them. And the interesting ones are the Labour ones. Now, those are the ones who are most affected by the Iraq war. But it's not that they necessarily feel Iraq is the issue in this election. It's simply that Iraq symbolises a lack of trust in Tony Blair. and Labour. It's what it symbolises rather than the issue of being in Iraq.
As if on cue, Barbara Hannock walks by.
I emailed you about our practice premises.
That's right.
And all my partners went,
I mean, never managed to find a date, but yes.
Hennock is not committed to any candidate or party in this election, although she has voted for Tony Blair in the past.
In fact, I did vote for Tony Blair his first time.
In 97.
Yeah, but right. I'm still considering where to put my vote at the moment.
To what degree is Iraq going to influence your decision as you float out there?
It won't be the biggest thing that sways my vote, but it's there, 5% or whatever.
Does it play into an idea of trust about him?
I think he was wrong, and he may have done it for the best reasons, but it shows, you know, that his judgment wasn't right. If we had a decent Green Party, I'd probably vote Green, to be honest.
The anecdotal evidence from Welwyn Garden City is mirrored in the polling data, according to Peter Kellner of the online public opinion research company, YouGov.
The Iraq War has had a big effect on trust. Before the war, Tony Blair's ratings were pretty high. They were beginning to slip, but after the war, they basically collapsed. Now, only a minority of the public think Tony Blair is trustworthy. And this means that they're less likely to vote Labour while he is Prime Minister, but also they're less likely to believe him when he talks about other issues, when he talks about government performance on schools, on hospitals, on crime, on public transport. People are much less likely to believe that what he says is true because he is tainted because of Iraq.
Kellner says this loss of trust goes way beyond the usual disenchantment that grows over time between voters and the politicians they elect. It is personal, directed entirely at the Prime Minister.
And one way you see this is when you ask people, generally speaking, which party do they identify with? Not quite the voting question, but who do they identify with? Labour still has a very substantial lead of around 12 percentage points, whereas current voting at the start of this campaign, Labour and Conservative are neck and neck. Now, what explains the fact that Labour loses so much ground between when you ask about general party identity and when you ask about voting? And it is because of Tony Blair, and it is the aftershock of Iraq. Because when you ask people how would they vote if Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer or Finance Minister, were leader of the party, Labour's lead shoots back up. Labour regains the support of those people who fundamentally think themselves as Labour, but at the moment, because of Iraq above all, feel they won't vote Labour or say they won't vote Labour on May the 5th.
The lack of trust feeds into a problem that Labour always has to overcome, the apathy of its core constituents, the less well-off scuffling to get by. Over on the other side of the Welwyn Garden City station, the wrong side of the tracks, it was virtually impossible to find any man in the Woodhall neighbourhood, a Labour ward, who was planning on voting at all.
I always have been a Labour man, but I mean, I'm not over-impressed with them, but as long as I'm earning my money and getting on with things, there's enough problems of my own to worry about.
I've never voted in my life.
Never?
No, never. What's the point? They're all just as bad as each other. Personally, I don't trust any of them. I don't trust the Labour government or the Conservative government or any of them.
No, I don't vote. Whoever gets in, there's going to be no worse off or better off, so I don't vote.
I've never voted. It's a waste of time.
Tony Blair's policy on Iraq has put his party in a difficult position. What is likely to keep Labour in power is the British electoral system. The party that wins the majority of seats in Parliament forms the government. Currently, Labour has a 160-plus seat majority. All polls indicate that Labour will lose a significant number of those, but because of recent changes to electoral district boundaries, there are simply more natural Labour voting constituencies in the country. If they manage to get back into power with only a 50 or 60 seat majority, and some polls predict it could be less, Blair may be forced by his own party to resign.
That's Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb reporting from London. You're listening to Here and Now.
Pater de celis Deus, miserere nobis.
115 Roman Catholic cardinals led a procession in prayer today on their way to the Sistine Chapel. The cardinals will choose a pontiff through secret ballot at their conclave, a ritual that dates back centuries. Here now is Deborah Becker, spoke to Professor Christopher Bellido of Kane University in Union, New Jersey, about the history of conclaves. He tells us they've been marred by corruption and scandal.
There is a kind of a whole string that maybe the New York Post history of the conclave, but in more recent times we've settled down, and you can focus on one or the other as you choose.
And the election of the Pope was also fraught with corruption throughout the years as well.
The ruling families of the city of Rome, you know, the Rockefellers and the Trumps and the I guess the Roosevelts and the Clintons too, were trying to put their favorite son in power. And so the conclave was fraught with people running in and out. This was even before we had something called a conclave. The conclave really doesn't exist until about 1274. And so the cardinals would gather, but it would be in an open room, in an open setting, and people would kind of go back and forth. And so the idea of locking the cardinals up accomplishes several purposes. One is, if you lock them up in bad conditions, maybe they'll elect pretty quickly, and that's not a bad thing. The second is, the idea of putting the cardinals away is kind of to protect the election. But even when we had a conclave for several hundred years, the emperors would still try to get in there. And there's a great story told about the conclave of 1549. Charles V is the Holy Roman Emperor. And he was, you know, trying to send notes and trying to get his information in there. And one way or the other, he had spies. And one way that he knew who was getting how many votes was that the dishes that were being passed out with the food, the dirty dishes that were being passed out, had names and vote counts chalked underneath them. So that when someone said to him, you know, I don't know what you call your emperor, your emperorness, said to him, you know, you're really not supposed to be involved in this secret election. He said, secrecy, I know when these guys go to the latrine.
And I think the whole story of starting the conclave is a good one. The story in the 13th century when the cardinals, after 3+ years, couldn't reach a decision on a pope.
Nearly 3 years. It was 1268 to 1271, which is the longest interregnum in church history. Interregnum, the English word sede vacante, the vacant see, or seat in Latin. And canon law at that time said that the cardinals had to meet to elect the pope in the city where the pope had died. And the popes moved around a lot in Europe in the Middle Ages because there's no mass media. So if you want to be out there, you have to actually go. So the popes moved around a lot, and this particular pope died in Viterbo. And so cardinals were walking around, and they weren't spending a lot of time voting because canon law also said at that time that if there was no pope, the cardinals controlled the papal treasury, which is not a big incentive for a quick election. But even then, the people of Viterbo started to get a little annoyed, and they finally locked them up in a palace, and they still didn't elect. So they went to the roof, and they ripped the roof off, and they started to throw things down on their heads. You know, one imagines kind of spoiled cannoli or something running down on their heads. And then a pope was elected by the name of Gregory, and he learned the lesson of history. And it's this pope named Gregory who, 3 years later, at the Second Council of Lyon in 1274, put into canon law cum clave, Latin for with a key.
And it's actually said that now, in the 20th century, we probably know less about conclaves than we did when they first started. Do you think you agree
absolutely.
With that?
There's a wonderful book called Behind Closed Doors by a history professor at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. His name is Frederick Baumgartner. And he went to the Vatican archives, and he found ballots, and he was able to go through up until about 1800 and say, you know, Cardinal so-and-so got X ballot, got X votes on the first ballot and X votes on the second ballot.
And no conclave in the past century has lasted longer than 5 days. Any predictions?
Have to go back to 1740 for a conclave that lasted, you know, any length of time. I think the conclave of 1740 was 6 months. But since the 19th century, they've been less than a week each. I think by Thursday, we'll have a pope.
All right. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Christopher Bellido is assistant history professor at Kane University in New Jersey. He spoke with Here and Now's Deborah Becker. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. The famed Boston Marathon, 26.2 grueling miles from Hopkinton to downtown Boston, is underway. It tracks about 22,000 runners. But for one California man, races like today's are a mere warm-up, actually a mere interlude. Dean Karnazes runs 100 miles just to get to a marathon and still clocks a more than respectable time of 3 hours and 15 minutes. He's been known to run 75 hours without stopping. He eats whole pizzas and cheesecakes without breaking his stride. Here now, producer Karen Miller-Metzen recently caught up with Karnazes, who wrote the newly released book Ultra Marathon Man. And to catch up with Dean, she had to put on her running shoes.
And the bass keeps running, running, and 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 running, running, and
we're running down Dartmouth Street right now. So far, we're not out of breath.
Starting slow. We'll pick it up later on.
What's an average daily run for you?
20 is good. 25 is better, but I usually do between 15 and 20 a day. I do between 100 and maybe 110 typically in a week.
Four marathons?
Yeah, about four marathons, yeah.
Dodging Boston taxis here.
New experience, yeah.
So I bet you can't find too many training partners who are going to run, you know, 110 miles a week with you at 4 in the morning.
No, periodically people join me along the way, but usually they don't go the whole way. Or they'll ride a bike a lot of times.
It's probably what I should have done. I know you ran in high school and then you didn't run for a number of years. So tell me about how this all got started again.
Well, I was in a bar on my 30th birthday, and at about 11 o'clock at night, I don't know, I just had this, I call it a midlife crisis. A lot of people say 30's too young to have a midlife crisis, but I think that's what I had. And decided that I wanted to start running again. So I walked out of the bar, walked back to my house. I lived around the corner, stripped down to my jockey briefs, started running south, and decided I want to try and run 30 miles on my 30th birthday.
So you ran through the night in your underwear, wearing black silk socks, if I remember from your book. Got there, you couldn't move, and you decided this is something I want to do more of?
It was a good hurt, yeah.
Now, your goal at this point is to run 300 miles. No, certainly not today with me.
Yeah, I mean, that's one goal. I think I just don't think when I get to 300, I'll stop.
Tell me about the time you ran a marathon in the South Pole.
I was lucky to be alive after that one. It was minus 40 degrees, and I ran with a face mask in front of me, goggles, all of which froze solid. The conditions changed a lot. I mean, I'm about a 2:30 marathoner, and I was running as hard as I could, and it took me 9 hours and 18 minutes. So in those 9 hours, it went from just sheer white opaque, where you literally were getting vertigo. I mean, you couldn't tell if you were running upside down or backwards. I mean, it's completely white. And then there's other times of crystal clarity where you could see for miles and miles.
And the bass keeps running, running, and running, running, and running, running.
After 5 or 6 miles of running, Dean agreed, finally, to let me stop. We sat down in the lobby of the downtown Boston hotel where he was staying, and I noticed he's not even sweating. That's when I asked him what it felt like to run his first 50-mile run, which was a qualifying race for his first 100-mile run.
Well, the race went okay. I qualified, but the finish was a little bit unanticipated in that once I got back inside my car, I got violently ill and got trapped in my car and crawled out and fell down onto the dirt, and that's how it ended up. But it was still a very proud moment for me because I qualified for the Western States 100.
So you were violently ill, cramped, couldn't move, trapped in your car because your arms were virtually paralyzed, and you were then planning on running 100 miles.
I like pain, I guess.
Well, tell me about your first 100-mile run.
Well, it was really an exploration into the unknown is what I liked. I mean, I wasn't sure how it would fare. Once I hit 50 miles, everything beyond that was new territory. It got worse and worse, and I kept thinking, it can't get any worse than this, and something worse would happen. My toenails would fall off, or I'd go blind, and kept struggling, and finally got to a point at mile 99 where I was crawling on all fours. I was reduced to something less than human, and then I rejuvenated and finished the race, and it was probably the most inspirational thing I've ever done.
So that was your first 100-mile run, but you've done longer than 100-mile runs.
Yeah, I kept seeing if I could expand, the envelope of human endurance. It intrigues me to see how far the body can be pushed. And, yeah, after 100, it was 135 across Death Valley in the summer. And that's about the longest organized solo running event. So I started entering relay races, so these 12-person relay races that were 199 miles long. And I didn't have 11 friends left at this point, so I did them by myself.
Tell me about some of the unusual things that happened to you on longer runs. I read in your book that you once fell asleep on the road.
Well, the first time it happened, I wasn't really sure what had gone on. I woke up and I was in the middle of the road running. And I thought, how did I get here? So I meandered back over to the shoulder, and then I heard a loud horn blasting, and I woke up again. I realized I was sleep running, and I didn't fall over. I just kept running for hundreds of feet, and I'd run right out in the middle of a road, and a car was barreling down toward me. So that's problematic.
Now, that was in one of your attempts to run 300 miles, and you haven't quite made 300 miles yet, but tell me about what you have done.
Well, the last run I did was 262 miles, so that was 10 marathons. And it was 75 hours of continuous running in some very difficult conditions and some very hilly terrain, as well as it rained for about 20 hours. So I consider it a 300-mile effort. Had the conditions been a little bit better, maybe I could have gone 300. But I felt satisfied after 262.
But you're still planning on doing 300.
Yeah, I'm still going to try 300.
Some of the medical problems that come along with this. People wonder, I wonder, is this okay for your body?
I've had my blood work done post and pre-race, and pre-race everything's normal. Post, it's out of whack. What I found is that things typically after 2 weeks are back to normal. So I don't feel like I'm doing any long-term damage. If I did, I wouldn't be doing it.
I mean, the things you do seem extraordinary to most people. Are they things that you feel that other people could do if they tried, or is there something about your build or your genetics that make you able to do it, whereas other people probably couldn't?
I think that's a good question. I think it's a combination of things. I've got good alignment, as they say, so I don't pronate or supinate, and my foot strike is really true, and my heel hits and rolls kind of perfectly. I do have good endurance. I mean, if you look at my resting heart rate, it's around 40. Maybe there's some genetic things there. But I think a lot of running these long races is mental. I mean, they say, for instance, with the Western States 100, you run the first 50 with your legs and the next 50 with your mind.
Dean Karnazes is the author of the newly released Ultra Marathon Man. He spoke with Here and Now's Karen Miller Medson out there on the Boston Marathon race course herself today during a recent visit to Boston. Let's get it started. Let's get it started in here. Let's get it started. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Good luck to all the runners in the marathon today. It's also Patriots Day in Boston, commemorating the shot heard round the world. Busy day here. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now. Lose control, a body or soul. Don't move too fast, people just take it slow. Don't get ahead, just jump into it. Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com. I'm Robin Young. Join us.